Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 56. It's July 16th, 2020. The Shyness Clinic is located in a nondescript office park on a busy road in Palo Alto, California. It has slate gray walls and dull burgundy furniture. The only sign of life is an underwater photograph of a clownfish peeping warily from the safety of an anemone's tentacles. The clinic is built around the idea that social skills are just like any other skill. Founders Philip Zimbardo and Lynn Henderson call their concept social fitness training. We might call it myelination through deep practice. We believe that people are shy not because they lack social skills, but because they haven't practiced them sufficiently, said therapist Nicole Shiloff. Talking on the phone or asking someone on a date is a learnable skill, exactly like a tennis forehand. The key is that people have to linger in that uncomfortable area, learn to tolerate the anxiety. If you practice, you can get to the level you want. The godfather of this kind of therapy is Dr. Albert Ellis. Ellis, who was born in 1913 and raised in the Bronx, was a painfully shy teenager, unable to bring himself to speak to women. But one afternoon, he decided to make a change. He sat on a bench near the New York Botanical Garden and chatted with every woman who sat down. In 1 month, he spoke with 130 women. 30 walked away immediately, he said. I talked with the other 100 for the first time in my life, no matter how anxious I was. Nobody vomited and ran away. Nobody called the cops. Ellis, who went on to write dozens of books, built a straight-talk, action-oriented approach that challenged the Freudian model of examining childhood experience. Neurosis is just a high-class word for whining, he said. The trouble with more therapy is that it helps you to feel better, but you don't get better. You have to back it up with action, action, action. Ellis's approach, combined with that of Dr. Aaron Beck, became known as cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been shown to be equal to or better than prescription drugs for combating depression, anxiety, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. As Ellis liked to point out, his ideas weren't new. They came from the Stoic philosophers like Epictetus, who said, "It's not events, but our opinions about them, which cause us suffering." Ellis, who died in 2007, was named the second most influential psychologist of the 20th century by the American Psychological Association. Carl Rogers was first, Freud was third. The Shyness Clinic session I attended, which included 8 clinically shy people, was typical. There was no talk about anybody's past, no attempt to deconstruct the root cause of shyness. There was only practice and feedback. Overseen by Shiloff's gentle but tough-minded coaching, correcting any inaccurate perceptions, and pushing them to try harder once more. It was like being at Meadowmount, Spartak, or any other talent hotbed. The clients start by attempting to master easier challenges, role-playing water cooler chat and phone calls. Over several months, they gradually progress to harder tasks, such as asking for a date. At the program's highest level, they perform Olympian feats of outgoingness, such as purposely embarrassing themselves by dropping a watermelon in the middle of a crowded supermarket. The point, Shiloff explained, is to fire the circuit and thus to linger in the discomfort a little longer each time. It is the staggering baby process all over again, although the clinic has more suitable ways to describe the sensation. One of Shiloff's clients, a college student I'll call David, compared his progress to moving up on levels of a video game. At first, it seems really confusing, like everything's coming at you from all angles, he said. But then you sort of figure it out, and pretty soon it feels natural. A smiling 26-year-old computer tech named Andre told me he hadn't talked to a woman for months before enrolling at the Shyness Clinic. Now he had just gone on 3 dates and signed up for a ballroom dancing class. "When I thought I was born this way, then I thought, what's the use?" Andre said. "But when it's a skill, everything changes." That's a few pages towards the very end of Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. I read a from it a couple of times recently. Enjoy it again. It's cool to, crosses several streams, as it were. You've got Stoicism showing up. And if you're interested in that sort of thing, just go find Ryan Holiday's site and buy some of his books. Obstacle is the Way and Daily Stoic and that kind of stuff. He's done a wonderful job of surveying that terrain and bringing it into current sort of form and easily digestible bits. Also the idea of, in terms of the age-old nature-nurture sort of debate, that it's helpful to look at a lot of these things as simply skills and to practice them and to start small and repeat and keep doing them. And then slowly over time, expand your capacity and expand your skills and keep working on those. It's like Kobe Bryant in basketball. They mentioned sports here. It's a fascinating idea, and it's freeing in a way. It's very freeing in a way, liberating, because it means we can all learn and develop and acquire new skills. And when we acquire these new skills and when we go through that kind of learning, we are also kind of transforming our identity. What we thought at one point in time about what we, quote, were, can change, can be shown to not as fixed and static and inhibiting as we thought it was at the time. So I don't know where you might be, what skills you might be working on, but it's fascinating. And I would say, too, I don't feel like we all have the tools yet to see what skills we should work on next, to assess our options in which ones to tackle, and to build it into a cohesive picture of ourselves. I think that there's so much entrepreneurial opportunity now. There was a post several years ago now where Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, was talking about how they wanted to sort of disrupt the transcript and the whole this whole sort of set of artifacts that we've had for a while, generations, so that you can evidence what you've been up to, and people have resumes and profiles, you know, LinkedIn or Indeed or any of this kind of stuff. And those are fine to a point, but they don't really provide a 4D picture. You know, when you see the Internet Movie Database, you can actually go see the movies. You can see the actors. You can see the fruits of the cinematographer and the director and the writer, and see what else they wrote and that kind of stuff. You can spelunk around. It's wonderful. All of the people. There's corollaries in music. Genius.com is trying to do it in sort of in lyrics a new way, provide annotations, that kind of thing. And Anil Dash and some folks were trying to do this on the tech side. Like, just imagine an Internet Movie Database of tech, of work, of all work, of advertising. These things might exist to see what people have done, so that we can all have our own sort of portfolios that just build over time. But as I look at it all, like, there's not some great unified way to do that yet. This morning I almost read from Laura Sandifer's book, Courage to Grow, about Acton Academy. I will soon, I think, read the contract that the students have created for themselves, that they hold each other accountable to. It's really interesting to imagine these small groups and what they're accomplishing together. They're simultaneously blending online learning and brick and mortar in a physical place at the same time learning. They're also blending highly individualized approach with a highly collective approach, that it's even more of a group bonding experience, I think, than larger, more structured schools. Ironically, you give people that much control over their own time, but the way they artfully sort of situate it inside the structure is really pretty fascinating. So I want to spend more time there. Obviously, I think too, you just imagine these kids and how that is their experience for all those years, elementary through high school, compared to mine, many of ours, very different models. And so I think they are going to be poised to be entrepreneurial right from the get, like right as they get past all this formal schooling period, where there's these succession of line segments, semester at a time, year at a time, 6-week period at a time, with syllabi and classes and requirements and all this stuff. And then you'd reach a point, all of us do, when you're sort of now on your own. There's no more line segments handed to you. It's just a big open space. I think these kids are being prepared for that reality exceptionally well. So I want to get into that more. I also like the idea of, I think it was Ellis in this bit from Talent Code, just deciding he was going to get over it and just going to get over it, get into it. He's very shy. And so what he's going to do is talk to 130 people. That reminds me of quite a few things that are fascinating. One of my MBA professors, one thing he would do is make every student in his class spend 2 weeks negotiating everything. You're not allowed to have a single transaction that you did not try to negotiate. And he had other stunts, you know, things he would make you do. There was a list of things that you would try to do and call and negotiate, like renting a car or booking a hotel room. Ask him what the room rate is and then talk him down. See, just see what happens. But even at the grocery store, you get to the checkout and you got milk and eggs and you ask the person at checkout if you can get the milk for cheaper. He simply wanted everybody to inject tracer ink through that little system, which it is, and negotiate things and see what happens. And there were fascinating conclusions there because you realize, it turns out, almost everything is negotiable. There's obviously arguments to be made that it's not worth the hassle, it's not worth the time. There's a reason things have prices and just move on through. What are you going to do? Save 17 cents? Is that worth any of your time at all? But it also, I think, was intended as a way to crack open this status quo that we all carry around. You see a price, you assume that's a price. Oh, that must be the price. It's what's written on the price tag. And it's quite fascinating to just get over it, get out there, get over it. There was at one of the TEDx Austins, which for some reason they quit doing a while back, at one of them, they had a young man speak. He was born in China, moved to the U.S. I think his story is that he had a corporate job, maybe at Microsoft, and wanted to pursue a startup. He and his wife agreed he'd have 6 months to give it a shot to pursue that dream. And he had a couple of VC firms interested. And at the 11th hour, the last minute, they backed out. He got rejected. And he found it somewhat devastating. He never faced that kind of rejection before. Didn't know what he was going to do. He was going to just go back and go back to work, have a salary job, and not take the risk. But he was only like 3 or 4 months into the 6 months that they agreed. And his wife said, no. I don't want you to look back and question this. You've got more time. And he went online into a forum for entrepreneurs and was asking questions about how do you deal with this much rejection? How do you handle it? And somebody suggested that he go out, very similar to this Dr. Ellis, and just get rejected 100 times. We'll get rejected once a day for 100 days because you get over it. David Goggins would say you callous your mind. You break out of your comfort zone. You lean into a healthy kind of suffering and you callous your mind where you learn that it's not that big of a deal actually. And his story is hilarious. Like he wrote a book. He got on all kinds of your Good Morning America type things, I believe. And this young man and his 100 days of rejection, he had to come up with, you know, he kept having to invent new ways to get rejected. So he would ask a stranger in a mall to, if they'd give him 10, 20 bucks, hey, will you give me 20 bucks? He apparently grabbed a bag of potato chips on Super Bowl Sunday and drove around in a neighborhood until he saw a place that was clearly having a Super Bowl party. He went up and rang the doorbell and said, hi, I have chips. Can I join your party? And I think one thing that hit those national morning shows is he went to a Krispy Kreme donut place and asked them to make donuts in the shape and colors of the Olympic rings, fully expecting just to get rejected on the spot and sent away. And the woman behind the counter said, well, tell me again, what are the colors of the Olympic rings? She started handling it for a customer, And he was embarrassed because he didn't know, and he had to go like get his phone and go look it up and show the thing to her. And she went in the back and made it, gave it to him for free, in a big box. She said something about the fryer, like they had to do it in two or three pieces, but they put it together, and he walked out of that shop with the Krispy Kreme donuts in the shape of the Olympic rings. Again, learning and just getting over it, and he's building real skill. So that it just begs a lot of questions. Like, what are the artificial lids that we all place on ourselves? Those are fascinating topics. And going back to some of the earlier stuff from Aldrich and the Sandifers and Acton and all of that, the distinctions of learning to know versus learning to be and learning to do, and blending all of those together is really fascinating and really powerful. So right now, for each of us, we all represent this unique set of skills. And it's what's fascinating too, is it can be so easy to absolutely miss and forget what it is that you know. We just take it for granted. I believe that was also covered in maybe yesterday's reading from Talent Code. I'm trying to remember. But it was the part where if you imagine, there was a researcher who, I think what was cited was not comparing oneself to Pavarotti or Willie Mays, legendary all-time greats, but as a gentleman in a chess club and looking around people that are ostensibly his peers and realizing some of them are just far better, and what's making them so much better, and the people that were better also kind of not even being aware how they got there, how they are, and that they are in fact even that much better or more talented at whatever thing it is. It's easy to miss. So where are the tools right now across all facets of life, not just in your particular job and your particular career track, but in your home? Like, are you handy or not? Like, you'll hear people say, I don't have a green thumb. I have a green thumb, or I'm just not handy. Nonsense. Like, you just haven't practiced it. You just haven't done it. And so when you hear Jeff Sandifer talk about the Acton Academy, he says, very Austin Kleon Steele like an artist, says, look, we have poached from Alcoholics Anonymous, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, gaming, Google HR. They have grabbed elements from all of these places and fused them into their model. And the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts part is sort of merit badges. You're developing these things. I watch my daughter right now, who is six, just learning like crazy, and she's benefited by this big board that has all of these skills and all of these merit badges. And it's fun to go work on things and continue the practice. Like, there's a lot of that. They're all in all these pieces, but there's not yet sort of that I can see any unifying kind of approach to all of that. And certainly hasn't floated up to even LinkedIn or somebody like that who is theoretically positioned to help in that way. There's all these online learning platforms with all these different disciplines. There's so much useful educational content of all kinds. Pick a subject you want to learn about. Just start at YouTube. And then there's just so many training engines. So making sense for all that and figuring out how to chart a path through all of that as adults who have been inculcated mostly with that factory educational model, it's a fascinating thing. A friend here in town too, his name's Darren Roberts. He has got a Harvard Law degree, UT undergrad, was an NFL coach, and now is a sort of a speaker and writer and just does all kinds of things, has a really cool job at UT. He talks about too, kind of flipping the script on some of these things. He talks about developing your rejection resume. Don't fill that resume. All of us, you know what I mean when I say resume, this template and the resume speak and the bullets and all this stuff. And you're here from this time to this time and this position from this time to this time. And here's the bullets of the things you did. He flips it and build one of your best failures. Where have you gotten, when, like, he got turned, I forget which schools turned him down, which NFL squads turned him down, when he tried this one venture and it completely failed. Build a resume of the stuff you failed. Go find that kind of failure and then go back. Then go back and do it again. Keep at it until you don't fail. So there's a lot of these interesting ideas floating about, and I'm convinced there's tremendous entrepreneurial opportunity within some of these pockets. Clearly the status quo at a macro level is very unsatisfying for all of us in different degrees, in different ways. And at a micro level, sort of Wendell Berry's Think Little, it's like, what can we change and do differently? And then how does that start to bubble up into small groups of people that really know and trust each other and hold each other accountable? And then how does that radiate up to the next level and transform whole neighborhoods, cities, countries? It's a fascinating topic. So, I don't know, just riffing from going back through my notes. Talent Code, helpfully, is one of those books that I highlighted all over the place and wrote all over the place. I'm not saying it's David Foster Wallace writing on Don DeLillo level of marginalia, but I did a lot of writing and scribbling in this thing, and like a helpful thing too is I kind of created my own footnotes in the back of other books and sources referenced, and it just makes it so easy to open up that book and really remember it better, get back in it more quickly, and to just hone in on the key parts, all those kinds of things. It's that very act of writing on top of things and taking notes and using the stuff is all, just that tiny little bit is also very of a piece with all the stuff I've been thinking about out loud here lately. Last bit, little final programming note for the day. I did get up very early this morning, right before five, got a bunch done early, and then light, you know, the sun comes up, walk the dog and do all those kinds of things and help get breakfast going for the crew here and stuff. Didn't record this and post this by 7, but I think I'll get there. I got to get a little better, I think, at just setting it all out the night before so that I can spring right into it and make it just that much easier to go do. It'd help if I recorded in the same room in this house every day, but I don't. But it's fun. I'm enjoying getting up that early, elongating the days, and I do intend to get where I'm posting these for you by 7. So whenever you might get up, hopefully it's there. Thanks, y'all.